Okay, so that means we can start, we can or continue, or whatever you want to call it, where we left off yesterday. So we had a brief look at dependent origination, Paticca-samuppada, so far, going through it quite quickly. Now I want to have a look at it in more detail. And obviously the place we have to start is with avijja itself. And then over the next few days we'll take it step by step all the way through the 12 links of dependent origination here. So I'm going to start off looking at avijja, and this is the Vibhanga Sutta in the Nidana Samhita, and it gives the definition of the various terms of dependent origination. I'll just briefly read this out. It's not all that interesting, but I'll read it out anyway, and then we can just discuss it very briefly here. And what, bhikkhus, is ignorance? Not knowing suffering, not knowing the origin of suffering, not knowing the cessation of suffering, not knowing the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called ignorance or avijja. So that is the standard definition of avijja in the suttas, dukkhe, anjana, etc., all the way down to the four, not knowing the four noble truths. The first thing that maybe we should just talk about a little bit is the meaning of avijja itself, what it actually means. Here it is translated as ignorance into English, which is, I guess, okay. It's not, perhaps not, it's not a translation that captures the full meaning of avijja for sure, because avijja is more, ignorance has a sense of not knowing in English, right? He's ignorant about mathematics, or ignorant about some kind of field of study. But of course, in Buddhism, it has much more to do with seeing things clearly, with having a sense of not being deluded, right? So ignorance here means delusion, it means wrong view, it means not seeing things in accordance with reality. That is the real meaning of ignorance here. So it's this blindness, it's that we're fumbling around in the dark, not knowing where we're going, right? This is really what it concerns. So that is the first thing, just to be clear on the meaning of avijja. The definition here in terms of the Four Noble Truths, not knowing the Four Noble Truths. Now, when we talk about knowledge in Buddhism, jnana, usually that refers to, you know, the stages of the Aryans, stream entry and all the way to arahantship. So normally it has a very high meaning. So the full knowledge of the Four Noble Truths only happens when you become a sotapanna, a sovan, I think it is in Sinhala, sovan, a stream entry. That's where you see these things for the first time. You know what the Dhamma is all about. But of course, as I was saying yesterday, these words like jnana, they have a contextual meaning. And sometimes it doesn't necessarily mean the full insight, the full understanding of these things. Sometimes it means more like a limited understanding. So if you have a little bit of understanding of the Four Noble Truths, right, as you start to kind of think in that sense, you could argue that your jnana, your knowledge, is increasing a little bit. You're getting a little bit more jnana, not the full jnana, but you have some understanding of what is going on there. When you read the suttas, you see the Buddha, he always compares the asuttava putujjana with the suttava aryasavako. And this asuttava putujjana is the putujjana, the ordinary person who has no knowledge of anything to do with Dhamma, right? Completely has no understanding of the teachings, has never heard any Dhamma, anything like that. On the other hand, you have the suttava aryasavaka, which is normally the Aryans, the stream enterers. But of course, in the Buddhist teaching, a lot of people are in between there somewhere, right? You're not the asuttava putujjana because you have some understanding of the Buddhist teachings, nor are you perhaps an Arya. You're somewhere in between. And so there is a lot of room there for kind of partial knowledge in the Buddhist teachings. And this is what kind of gives us some, this is why it's interesting to read about the Four Noble Truths, because at least you are approaching this understanding here. It doesn't mean that you are completely, in other words, avijja. You're starting to eliminate avijja as soon as you start to contemplate the Four Noble Truths in the right way here. So this is, I think, an important point. Otherwise, it kind of takes away some of the effort into studying what these things are about. So this is one way of understanding ignorance or avijja. Four Noble Truths. Of course, in the suttas, there are other ways of understanding this. If you look at the gradual training, the the gradual training as we find it in the suttas, like you find it in the Chulahatipadopama Sutta, the shorter discourse on the elephant's footprint, for example. There, the vijja is called the three higher knowledges, right? You have the recollection of past lives, you have the understanding of karma, and you have the destruction or the ending of the asavas. That is the three, that is what is vijja in the gradual training here. So how does vijja in dependent origination, understanding the Four Noble Truths, how does that fit with the vijja in the gradual training here? Right, all of these things should somehow fit together, right? Because they're all part of the same Dhamma, part of the same picture. So there has to be some way that these things fit together here. And of course they do, and if you know how the suttas work, you will of course know that understanding past lives is essentially an understanding of the truth of suffering. You see the problem, you see the five khandhas, you see existence perpetuating itself from life to life, right? And you get this sense of nibbida, the sense of repulsion we were talking about yesterday, the sense of revulsion even from existence, because you see this thing going on for the future. So that is the first noble truth, very similar to understanding the seeing, the idea of rebirth. Because what you are seeing is the five khandhas, right? The five khandhas going on, moving on from life to life. That's really all you're seeing. And of course, understanding the first noble truth is also about insight into the five khandhas. It's a very similar kind of idea. And understanding the laws of karma, how, why it is that you get reborn in a certain way, is very similar to the second noble truth. You can see the mechanism that drives rebirth, the mechanism that drives suffering, how it is perpetuated into the future. And then the very last one of the tevijja is the understanding of the elimination of all the asavas. That, of course, is very similar to the third noble truth, in the sense that you are when you eliminate all the asavas, you find the highest happiness, the ending of all suffering. And I think there are many ways you can look at this, probably, but there's a very close relationship between the two. And that gives you a little bit of handle on what is going on here. So what I want to do now is I want to have a look at the Four Noble Truths in more detail, because I think they are very interesting. And of course, they are the core kind of message of the Buddha. If you summarize his teaching, he uses the Four Noble Truths. And of course, the place to look for the Four Noble Truths, the one place where they were taught, first of all, is always the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. So let's have a look at the Dhammacakka Sutta today, or this morning, and see what we get out of these Four Noble Truths. Okay, so here we go. This is the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, found in the Sanyutta Nikaya. This is the Satcha Sanyutta, the last Sanyutta of the Sanyutta Nikaya. And this is how it goes. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Varanasi, in the deer park at Isipatana. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus of the group of five, thus: Because these two extremes should not be followed or pursued by one who has gone forth into homelessness. What too? The pursuit of sensual happiness in sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of the worldling, ignoble, unbeneficial, and the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct insight, to awakening, and to extinguishment. So that is how the Buddha starts off talking about his path, or his discovery, which is talking about the middle way. And of course, there is some historical context there. The historical context is that the five ascetics, the group of five, the Panchavagya Bhikkhu, they left the Buddha because they thought he was backsliding, right? He stopped torturing himself. He stopped kind of not eating. So they said, okay, this fellow, he's not going to make it anywhere because he has given up the real practice. So they left him. And of course, the Buddha has to convince them that he actually has discovered something profound. So that's why, one of the reasons why he starts with this idea of the middle way. But it is a very, I think it is a very important teaching, this idea of the middle way. And it's something that is so easy to forget, as I was saying here on the very first day when I just arrived. Because I think it is in our human nature that we tend to veer towards extremes. Either we indulge in sensuality, or we kind of think, yeah, I'm going to get those sensual pleasures, sensual desires, and we move into tormenting ourselves, self-mortification, and this kind of thing here. It is no accident that this was the kind of way that asceticism, spirituality, was done in those days in India. Right? It is no accident, because this is kind of part of human nature. We tend to think like that. It is not only in the Brahmanical or the Hindu tradition you find that. You find it across the world. You find it in Christianity. You find it in Islam, apparently. You find it everywhere. It seems to be something very deep in human beings. But if you're going to practice spirituality, the way to do that is to torment the flesh. Because by tormenting the flesh, you are releasing yourself from the evil sins or the evil desires of the flesh or the bad desires of the flesh, kind of by torturing it or countering that. But the Buddha says, no, it is the wrong way. So remember that, because it's so easy to fall into those extremes and think that you're actually making progress when the real path is really the middle way. When you practice the middle way, that is when it's possible to go beyond the body, go beyond the senses, because they basically become irrelevant when you do that. So please keep this in mind. So you should not pursue these sensual pleasures, the Buddha says, which are low. The word for low is hina, hina, right? And the reason why they are low is because you don't get much happiness from them. There isn't much happiness there compared to the other happinesses that are available on the Buddhist path. So they are hina. If you look at the way the Buddha describes the world, or describes rebirth, is the hina dhatu. The hina dhatu is the kama dhatu, is the world, or kama vachara, which is the world of sensuality. All the realms of rebirth in sensuality. And then you have the majjhima dhatu. Majjhima is the world of the jhanas, right? So you might think, wow, the jhanas, this is pretty high. The Buddha calls it the majjhima dhatu, the middle realm. And then, of course, the higher, the panita dhatu, is the immaterial attainments. So this is the meaning of hina. It means inferior. It means lower. And then we have the word vulgar here, which the Pali word is gammo. Gammo means of the village, pertaining to the village, related to the village. So it really means ordinary. It means a common kind of happiness. Vulgar has a kind of negative meaning in English these days. It doesn't mean that. It just means it's ordinary. It's of the common people. It is the way of the worldlings, the portujaniko, of the portujanas, the way of the ordinary person who don't have any greater insight, right? Ignoble, again, not of the Aryans. Unbeneficial, right? It doesn't have any benefit. It doesn't get you anywhere. You're not actually going anywhere. This, I think, is such an important thing to understand. As long as you indulge in that world of sensuality, it doesn't actually have any ending, it doesn't have any solution, it doesn't have any goal, it doesn't have any purpose. All it does is keeps you trapped in samsara. It just goes on and on and on forever. And this is, I think, one of those very important problems with sensuality. Craving just keeps going. Craving is a self-perpetuating force that keeps on going and going by itself, and there's no solution there to be found at all. And if you keep on staying with that, you are basically trapped, and you're not going to get out of the samsaric circle of things. It's kind of scary that craving is perpetuating, self-perpetuating. It makes you want to rebel against craving and say, enough of this. I don't want to have anything to do with this anymore. This is kind of scary. I'm trapped by this. This is not going to lead me anywhere at all. So it's unbeneficial, right? And then the second one is self-mortification, which is painful, right? The other one was low. This is painful. The difference is that low means there is a little bit of happiness there. When it's painful, there's no happiness at all. So this is, in one way, it's even worse, right? It's painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. So it's, in a way, it is even worse than sensuality. Of course, the problem with sensuality, it tends to trap you more because there is some attraction there. So it is dangerous in another way. But this one is dangerous for the very fact that it is simply painful. and unbeneficial. Again, it doesn't get you anywhere. Tormenting yourself, torturing yourself is not actually doesn't have any positive outcome. It's one of those things that I also always noticed from the suttas, is that there is very little emphasis in the suttas on the Dutanga practices. There's very little emphasis there. The emphasis is really on the middle way, finding that balance. And Dutangas are not really talked about very much at all. And if they are, it is very fairly simple Dutangas, like wearing a rag robe and that sort of thing, which is kind of nice. It is not very painful or very bad as such. Or being a Pindacharika bhikkhu, which is also, of course, can be fine as well. But those more severe Dutangas, like the Nisajjika, etc., they're not even, they're very rarely even talked about in the suttas as such. And you find them more in places like the Visuddhimagga. Then the Buddha, without veering to these extremes, he has awakened to the middle way, right? And this is the way, this Majjhima Patipada, this is the one, not the other ones, not the extremes, but this one, gives rise to vision, dasana, to knowledge, jnana, peace, upasama, insight, abhinya, sambodha, awakening, and lastly, nibbana, which is extinguishment. This is the way that leads to these things. And what is that way? That is the next paragraph here. And what, because is that middle way awakened to by the Tathagata, which gives rise to all these wonderful and amazing things? It is this noble eightfold path, which is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. This, because, is the middle way awakened to by the Tathagata, which gives rise to vision, gives rise to knowledge, leads to peace, to insight, to awakening, and to extinguishment. So that is the Noble Eightfold Path for you. And why is it that the Noble Eightfold Path leads to awakening? And this, of course, is very important to understand in conjunction with dependent origination. Why does it lead to awakening? Because it eliminates the defilements of the mind. That is why it goes there, right? So it's all about eliminating the defilements. I always like to think that if we should talk about anything as the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, it is really the Noble Eightfold Path that deserves that name. This is the path of purification. You start off with a little bit of right view. So once you have the right view, the second factor becomes, you start to aim in the right way, right? If you see things, understand things in the right way, your aim in life becomes right. You start to aim accordance with that right view. You start to be kind. You start to be compassionate. You start to renounce the sensuality, etc. Because you're aiming in the right way. This is the way I like to translate Samma Sankappa these days, right aim. Because of right aim, you start to do things in accordance with that aim. Samma Vacha, Samma Kamanta, Samma Ajiva, right? You practice morality, you practice kindness in your life. And this is the first stage of purification. Then, when your bodily and verbal conduct is roughly right, then you start to be concerned about the mind, right? The coarser aspects, the coarser defilements have been put away. You start to look at the more refined defilements of the mind. That is what Samma Vayama, Samma Padana is all about, the removal of all the defilements of the mind. If you look at how this is defined in the suttas, it's all about removing the bad states, building up the good states in the mind. Then you go to Samma Sati, a right mindfulness. And again, it's about the last purification of the mind, the removal of the very last hindrances, and the development of the bhujangas is one of the main aspects of Satipatthana practice, Samma Sati. So all about purification, right? And then when your mind finally is completely pure, that is when you can enter the deep states of samadhi, which are the jhanas, the last factor of the path. And when you reach the last factor of the path, because you have, on the one hand, you have the jhanas, you have the samadhi, on the other hand, you have the right view from the very beginning, those two things together allows you then to get the insights and to eliminate avijja, eliminating the root cause of dependent arising, and thereby allowing yourself to be liberated from all that. So it's very, I think the Noble Eightfold Path can be understood in such simple terms, a path of purifying yourself, a gradual purification, until eventually you reach samadhi, which is I think it's a fairly nice and simple way of understanding that path. Okay, anyway, let's not go into more details. I talked about the Noble Eightfold Path for the full retreat last year. There's obviously a lot of information there that can be talked about, very interesting to consider. But now let us have a look at the Four Noble Truths. They're coming up next. Now, this figure is the noble truth of suffering here. Birth is suffering, old age is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering, union with what is displeasing is suffering, separation from what is pleasing is suffering, not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five factors of personality here, subject to clinging, are suffering, or subject to grasping, are suffering here. So this is the first noble truth, and I'm sure you have heard it many, many times before. But it is always, I think, good to reflect on it a little bit, because if you remember that we're talking here about avidya, and if you reflect on the first noble truth in the right way, it means that you are starting to eliminate avidya. You're starting to eliminate the root cause of dependent origination. So very useful to reflect on this, and not just now, but all the time, right? These aspects here are actually what helps you to move in the right direction. So it starts off with birth is suffering here. And it is kind of curious that that it should start with birth is suffering here, because birth is something that is kind of behind us. We kind of finished with birth, right? We were already born in this life. So why is birth there here? Remember, the whole purpose of the Four Noble Truths, to come to the second noble truth, is to eliminate the cause of suffering, right? So that suffering doesn't arise in the future. So the only way we can explain that birth is in here is because it refers to rebirth. So rebirth is really the only way that birth makes any sense in the first noble truth. So this is the first thing to be aware of, right? So rebirth is suffering. Our past birth is really quite irrelevant. It doesn't really matter anymore. So what does it mean that rebirth is suffering, or any kind of birth is suffering? What does that actually refer to? And obviously, I think the very simple answer to that is that the very physical process of being born itself probably is not very nice, probably involves quite a bit of suffering, both for the mother and also for the child. This obviously here concerns the child. That is one aspect of it. But I think there is something much more profound going on here than just that. And that profundity, I think, is very nicely illustrated by a story which I probably told you before. There was a little story that was a newspaper clipping that Ajahn Brahm, my teacher in Perth, had clipped out from, had received from somebody in the United States. It was a clipping from an American newspaper. And according to this newspaper article, there was a certain hospital somewhere in the U.S. This child, this baby had just been born, right? And just been born, just come out. And then it opens its mouth and says, "Oh no, not again." Right? Imagine the baby saying that. Oh, wait, what's going on here? If you are a Buddhist as a parent, you understand straight away. If you are something else, you might wonder, oh, what is a very spooky here? But I think this is kind of the point, right? This is sort of the point of the whole process of being born. Imagine yourself, you're kind of somewhere, perhaps ready to get born somewhere, right? Maybe you are in the Deva realm, maybe you are in the Antarabhava. I'm one of those people who believe in Antarabhava. I go against the Theravada establishment and believe there is such a thing as an Antarabhava. Imagine yourself, you are finally died, right? You're free of that physical body. You're kind of sitting in the Antarabhava, waiting for Kamma to take its course and lead you on to its new rebirth. And you're so happy, right? Finally died. Your body was so old, it was falling apart. You were sick. And finally you get rid of that terrible body. You feel so light, you feel so joyful, because the body is gone. And now you see, you are heading towards a new rebirth, right? Oh no, not again. You can see yourself being trapped in this body for another lifetime. You can see the cycle going on. You can see yourself doing all the same mistakes one more time. You can see your life lined up in front of you. Childhood, youth, education, becoming a parent. Again, right? And again. And you start to get this feeling for samsara. You start to get this feeling, this is not the first time. This has happened to me so many times. And you can start to see the pointlessness of this whole thing. You're not actually going anywhere. It isn't heading anywhere. It's just the same thing over and over and over, and over and over and over, etc., 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 going on and on and on. And that, I think, is part of that feeling you have at that time when you are about to get reborn, about to enter into a new existence, especially if it is a human existence or something like that. If you're heading for a Deva realm, probably it is not so bad, but if it is a human existence, I think it is the case. So rebirth, I think, is this feeling. You're starting to see the big picture. You're starting to see that this whole process is actually a trap. You're trapped by this. And that is when you get a little bit of sense of, oh no, not again. So that is the idea of birth is suffering. It's always quite fascinating. These things always have a meaning. It wouldn't be in there unless it had a meaning here. And it's not something that is just in the Pali tradition. Birth is suffering is found across the board in all Buddhist traditions. This is a root Buddhist teaching here. Okay, old age is suffering, right? Old age is suffering. I'm sure we can all understand why that is the case. But it's worthwhile reflecting a little bit on this as well. And remember that old age is it's very sometimes hard to look at, right? You turn your face away, don't really want to see it. When somebody is really, really old, it is quite unpleasant, right? They can't look after themselves anymore. They just have to, they're usually just lying there all the time. People have to feed them, people have to clean them, people have to do everything for you. You can't see anything, you can't hear very much anymore, you can't really walk, right? You become completely incapacitated. It's very humiliating to become very old. It's very difficult to accept, very difficult to deal with. And we are all heading there, we're all going there, right? There's nobody very old here, because if they were very old, they wouldn't be, they can't come. That's the way it is when you're very old. So it's worth by reflecting on that. It's worth by getting to grips with that while you're still relatively young. The younger you are, the more you can understand that old age is part of you. Youth and old age are opposite sides of the same coin. Old age is already inside of you. It's waiting to kind of come forth, right? It is there. So remember that when you're young, and then you dispel some of that delusion that we have when we are young, or even when you are middle-aged or whatever, still that delusion is still there. So remember this simple thing sometimes, simple realities of life. Yeah, I know about old age, no need to talk about that anymore. No, we don't know about old age, right? This is the problem. It's actually quite profound. It's actually something very deep. It is something that is emotionally difficult to accept. And that's why you need to think about these things again and again. And illness, of course, illness and suffering is a very similar kind of thing. When you get very ill, it's a very similar situation as when you're being old. You are incapacitated. It is not nice. I like the way Ajahn Brahma always puts this. He always says that when you go to the doctor, you should always never say to the doctor that, oh, doctor, something is wrong with me, I'm sick again. You should say instead, doctor, something is right with me, I'm sick again today. Right? Sickness and health, again, two sides of the same coin, cannot be avoided in life. There's always going to be some degree of sickness and illness. But then we get to the last one of these first four aspects here. Death is suffering, and this is obviously the most important one of all of these initial part of the First Noble Truth. And death is suffering is, I think, very, again, one of those fairly profound things, because death involves so much detachment. When you come to your final stages of life towards the very end, in a sense, you are forced to detach. And if you don't detach, you're going to suffer enormously as a consequence. So it is very difficult, because remember, most of us, especially lay people, but also a monastic, if you don't practice fully, is that we spend most of our life attaching to things. We spend most of our life building up this life in a certain way, right? You build up a fortune, you build up a nice house, you build up relationships to the people around you. You may get very attached to your wife or to your husband or to your children or whatever it is. We build up a career, we build up a sense of self of who we are, what our social relationship is to other people and all these kind of things. Everything in this life is about building up things that belong to this world. Everything belongs to this world, right? And then you come to the end of life, and all you have been doing is building up stuff that belongs to this world. And now you have to let go of all of that. Right? That's terrible. You can imagine. And you start wondering, what was this all about? What was the purpose of all of this? I've been spending so much time, so much effort, all my energy on this life. And now I have to give it all up. I've been foolish. I've been stupid. You come to the end of your life and you realize you have been deluded all along by actually grasping onto those things that you have to let go of and not really investing in those things that are going to be with you also in the future. This is why the idea of rebirth is so important. If you have an idea of rebirth, it changes your investment strategy, right? We have to bring in modern finance a little bit, I reckon, so just to make it more interesting. So it changes your investment strategy here. You see, instead of seeing this tiny slice of existence, you see something much more, and you start to think in a very different way here. You start to think about how can I do something that will lead to the long-term happiness, rather than coming to the end of my life and saying, what was the point? What was the purpose? I wasted my time. I have to give up everything here. So when you come to your deathbed, you know, you start to realize, okay, I'm going to have to give up all my belongings. I'm going to have to give up all my friends, my family. I have to give up my body. I'm going to have to give up so much of the mental things, so many of those things that have to do with the present life, my social position, all of that. So once you start to think like that, you start to remember death and understand that, it turns your mind in a different direction. And this is why this is so powerful, such a powerful reflection to use. I'm going to talk a little bit more about death recollection later on this retreat, but this is just like an introduction to remind you of this. So please remember that. When you remember death, when you remember things in this way, what does it do? What it does, it reduces your attachment and desires for this world, because you look at the bigger picture of things. Because it reduces the desires and attachments, it also reduces any ill will at the same time. Desire and ill will are very closely connected to each other. And when it reduces all that, you get more clarity of mind, right? More clarity of mind means less avijja. So all of these contemplations I've been talking about now, they actually reduce your avijja. And this is why not knowing the Four Noble Truths is avijja. Knowing them a little bit is less avijja. Right? So very simple. You know, we think that, oh, understanding the Four Noble Truths is so difficult. Can't do it. I don't know how to do it. Oh, this teaching is so profound. But actually, it is not really that profound. It is just it is profound because we have bad habits, because we're looking at things in the wrong way. That is why it is profound. It is not profound in the sense that we can't do it. We can do it. It's just a matter of turning our attention in a slightly different direction, thinking about things in a new way, and then every one of us is capable of understanding these things. Every one of us is capable of understanding death, right? It's got nothing to do with intelligence or anything like that. Death is something all of us can bring to heart, bring home, think about, and then make a more powerful perception in our mind. So this is how ignorance is gradually abandoned. Then we have a union with what is displeasing is suffering, separation from what is pleasing is suffering. And this is very closely related to one of the other contemplations that we find in the suttas, which is the contemplation that I will be separated and disjoined from all the things that are dear and pleasing to me. Right? I'm sure you know that famous contemplation, the five contemplations that are listed for everyone, that everybody should do, whether you are a lay person or a monastic, whether you are a female or male, doesn't matter. This is a contemplation everybody should be doing here. So remember that. I must be separated from everything that is dear and pleasing to me. Everything, right? It's not just about your death, it's about the death of other people as well. And once that kind of starts to come home to you, that this must be the case, again, you start to detach a little bit. You start to have more vijja. You understand the nature of existence. So this is one of the most powerful aspects of being separated from what is pleasing. People dying, people becoming sick, because people is where we have often our strongest attachments, right? Because we're often very close to other people. But it's true in a very, also very in a very everyday sense, that every day of our life, there's always stuff that is happening in our life that is displeasing, that is unpleasant. Even when you come here to Bandrabila, I think, oh, I'm going to have a nice retreat, just relax. But every day there are little things that are displeasing and not quite right. And after a while, you start to realize this is the nature of things, right? People say things which aren't quite nice. The body doesn't want to play ball and has kind of pains and aches. This is always going to be like that. It cannot be changed. And because it cannot be changed, okay, you're at peace with it. You say, fine, that is the nature of the world. No worries, I'm not going to allow myself to be distracted by those things. Then we have the second last one here, is not to get what one wants is suffering, right? I'm sure you all know what that means. Sometimes we strive in life, we strive to get something, especially in the sensual existence. We cannot really control the world. And because we cannot control the world, we cannot control outside phenomena, it means that very often we don't get those things that we want. We want that relationship. We want this person, but we can't have it because the other person, unfortunately, is not interested in us. We strive very hard, we work very hard to build up money, and then we invest wrongly and we lose it all on the stock market or whatever. Or we work very hard, but we don't get the results we're hoping for. It is so unreliable, so uncertain, the world inside. And that is why we then turn instead towards the world inside. If we cannot create what we want outside, at least there is some hope that we can create that inside of ourselves. The control that you have on the world outside is very small. The sense of control, the ability to do something with the world inside, is obviously much greater because it relates directly to us. But even there, we have to be very careful, because even with the world inside, sometimes things don't go according to plan. You try to develop your mind, you don't succeed. And then the reason why you don't succeed is usually because you haven't looked carefully enough. You haven't been honest with you enough about where your defilements are, where your problems are. And that is why you're not making progress anymore. So one of the things about the Buddhist path, it demands a lot of honesty. It demands that we look at ourselves in the right way. Then we come to the very last part of the First Noble Truth, which is that, in brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. I think this shows you the limitation sometimes of how things are translated, right? The five aggregates subject to clinging. It's kind of what they call Buddhist hybrid English. It's not real English. You know, if you say that to somebody on the street, yeah, the five aggregates are subject to clinging, they think you're crazy, because nobody really, it doesn't make any sense to anything, anybody. So much better to say something like the five factors of personality, or the five aspects of personality that are grasped, right? That are held onto. The five factors of personality that are held onto, these are suffering. Then I think people might start to understand what you're talking about. So I don't want to criticize anybody. This is a translation by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, and he is a very good translator. I certainly don't want to criticize him, because it's very, very hard to translate and very difficult to get these things absolutely right. In fact, it is impossible to get them absolutely right, because if you translate it one way, it will have one defect. Translate it in a different way, it will have another defect. So there is no such thing as a perfect translation, unfortunately. And that is why sometimes it is good to discuss these things a little bit. But anyway, let's not get too sidetracked by that. The five aggregate subjects, now you see how we slide back into this, the five personality factors that are subject or that are grasped are suffering. So what does this mean? How can we get a handle on this? How can we understand this? As a theory, it sounds very hard to understand what is going on. Right? Five, yes, okay, they are suffering. We can kind of recite that, but it doesn't really grasp us emotionally. To grasp us emotionally, we have to see this for ourselves to a certain extent. And this is one of the things that meditation practice is all about, actually seeing this. And this is something that all of us has the ability to see, at least to some degree. It is not something that is very it is very profound in one sense, but you can start to see this already fairly early on in your meditation practice. And the way you can see that is that as you meditate, right? We all have had some times when we feel a little bit more peaceful, we feel a little bit more relaxed, we feel a little bit more at ease. Sometimes you get some very nice meditations, right? And then ask yourself the simple question, why is that meditation so nice? What is it about it? And one very big reason why a meditation is nice is because you have abandoned things. You have let go of things. Things have disappeared, right? The body is starting to disappear. All you have left is the breath. That is actually very nice when the body disappears. Your will is calming down. There's less intention, less volition going on in the mind. It is very nice when that is happening. There is less thinking going on. Wow, that is also very nice. There is less perception of the external world. Your eyes are shutting down. Your ears are shutting down. That is very nice. And so what is going on there is that your aggregates are becoming more refined. Your aggregates are starting to disappear. Remember that the five aggregates, what they are, a very easy way to understand in the five aggregates, they are just experience itself. So right now, when you're sitting here, you're experiencing all this, whatever it is, that is for the five aggregates right here, right now. So when you're becoming more peaceful, there is less of the five aggregates. Those five aggregates you have abandoned must have been suffering, otherwise it wouldn't have been more, otherwise you wouldn't have more happiness. Right? So you can start to see how those aggregates, how experience itself actually is a problem. And as you are moving away from experience, as experience is becoming more refined, more peaceful, as there is less experience in your life, actually there is more happiness. This is a very easy way to understanding the five aggregates and why they are suffering here. Sometimes it is so difficult to get a handle on these things. We need a practical approach. And that practical approach, it which allows us to understand the Dhamma fully. Of course, it's a very profound teaching, because what it means that not only is it good when it starts to calm down and it starts to become more peaceful, but it means that the less there is of those aggregates, the more happy you are. And of course, if you take that to the extreme, it means that when they are completely gone, completely disappeared, when there's a full cessation, nothing is left, that is when you have the highest happiness. That is the consequence of that. And sometimes people think, that's scary. That's really scary. Everything is gone. I don't want that to happen. And you can see why people feel that. The reason why you feel that is because of the sense of self. The sense of self is getting in the way. So the way to do this is to understand that when things become more peaceful, there is less sense of self there as well. There's less things to grasp onto. There's less things that you can identify with, etc., etc. So less sense of self too is happy. That's the other thing you start to see. So instead of coming from a theoretical and intellectual position, that the idea that ending of everything is scary, that the idea of non-self is frightening, you come from experience and you understand that the idea of non-self actually is liberating, it's peaceful, it's beautiful. And you start to get this idea that if I eliminate it all, wow, it's going to be very powerful and very positive experience. So this is the most profound aspect of the First Noble Truth, but please contemplate it in a practical way, and if you do that, then you will start to see that this actually is the case. This is within the grasp of all of us to see these things, at least to some degree, and eventually doing it more deeply. So there you are, First Noble Truth, actually very practical, right? So please think about it in that way, or whatever way works for you. Of course, you don't have to think about it in the way I am suggesting. I'm just giving you some ideas. Find your own way. Whatever works for you is the best way here. Okay, so let's move on to the second noble truth. Now, this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering here. It is this craving which leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. That is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for extermination. So this is the origin of suffering, is craving, the craving which leads to renewed existence, the porno bhavika tanha. So it's quite specific here, the kind of craving we're talking about. And as we saw, as I was talking about yesterday, the craving for sensual pleasures and the craving for existence, these are always things in the future. We're always projecting ourselves into the future, aiming for something in the future, right? This sensual pleasures, craving for existence, by the definition, is the aiming of something in the future. And because we're aiming for something in the future, we're projecting ourselves. And as we do that, we also get reborn into a future life based on that. So this is the craving that is meant here, that is talked about, this craving for new existence, accompanied by delight and lust. Mandiraga sahagata. Right? Delight. Nandi. We delight in things. Wow, the world is so beautiful. All of these things are so great, right? Oh, it's so nice. Nandi. Lust is just another word for desire, really. So it's very similar to tanha itself. Seeking delight here and there. There's always somewhere else to seek delight, right? Always something more to get hold of in the world. It doesn't matter how much you've got. There's always more to be had. And as long as craving is still active, there's always more that you will get. Even if you own the whole universe, then you want another universe. That is the problem. And one universe should have you enough trouble already. Still, you want another universe as a consequence of craving here. So this is the problem. And one of the problems with this, the second noble truth, is that very often we identify with craving. We think that craving is important. Sometimes you tell people to, you know, oh, we should abandon craving, because when you abandon craving, things become peaceful and delightful. And to some level, they can understand that. But then they will say, but craving is what makes life meaningful, right? When I crave, it means that I have desire, it means I have goals, I have purposes in life, I have something to live for. Craving is what makes life livable. If you take away craving, all you create is this nothing. There's like this hole, right? Oh, what now? There's nowhere to go anymore, there's nothing to aim for. Life becomes meaningless without craving. Right? So this is how people sometimes think. And the reason they think like that is because they don't really understand what absence of craving actually means. Absence of craving is not the state, your ordinary state, and just take away craving. That would indeed be meaningful. The reason why craving can disappear is because you build up something in its place. And this is kind of the important thing here. And what you build up through your goodness, through your kindness, through your meditation practice, is you build up inside yourself a sense of contentment and happiness. And that is why craving dies down. Craving isn't just eliminated, it dies down because you have something much more powerful, much more beautiful inside of you. And all of those things, you know, you think that craving is purposeful because it will lead you to somewhere in the future, somewhere which is happy. All of that craving promised you, all of those things that craving said, yeah, you will be happy when you pursue this, you will be happy when you get this, that actually comes by abandoning craving and finding the contentment and the happiness inside of you instead. And one day you realize that. You realize, wow, craving was promising all these things. Craving was lying to me. Craving was leading me astray. Now that I have abandoned craving, now that I have discovered the inner happiness instead, I have actually found those things that craving were promising me in the first place. Right? Craving promises you, but it tells you the wrong way of getting those things. And then you turn around, look somewhere else, and then you find the things that craving were promising you. So be careful not to be led astray by craving. It's easy to think that craving desires are important in life because they give us a sense of purpose. But the point is, the purpose is empty. The goal is empty. It doesn't go anywhere. You don't actually get those things in the first place. It's a lie. So look at the lying of the craving, and then you start to see what is going on here. And also because of craving being so important to people sometimes, sometimes we take craving as the self. I am the craving, right? I think it's in the Chachaka Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, 146 or something like that. That sutta talks about craving. Sometimes we take that as ourself. I am the desire. I am the craving here. And because you take it as a self, because you take it as an identity, again, same problem, right? Very difficult to give up as a consequence. So these are the things to be careful about. So That is the second noble truth for you in brief. I just want to finish the last two noble truths very quickly before we end the session. We've got a couple of more minutes before we have done the full hour. So that is those cravings. And you will see there the craving for existence, the craving for sensual pleasure. These are exactly the cravings I was talking about yesterday in connection with sankhara, right? Sankhara are the things which create the activities that you do as a consequence of this craving, as a consequence of avidya. Okay. Let's have a quick look at the third noble truth. Now this, speakers, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering here. It is the remainderless fading away, the cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it. So that is when you end suffering, is by ending that craving completely. Full cessation, right? The giving it up and relinquishing of it, the chaga, patinisaga of that craving. So it never comes back again. Not only does it cease temporarily, it is the final relinquishment of that craving. The freedom from it, right? The mutti from the craving. The craving is like this leash around your neck. You're being tied to this leash, being pulled around samsara. You are a slave to craving, as it says in the Ratapala Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya 82. You are a slave to craving. Craving is in charge. And you are just this a person running around like a dog with a leash around your neck, always seeking for new sensations. Now you're free from it. You are no longer enslaved. Non-reliance on it. You don't rely on these things. The Pali word here is analaya. So this is analaya. No longer relying on the craving. Analaya is like a resting place or a roosting place that you rely on. Like the Himalaya, Hima, snow, alaya, where the snow rests, right? You rely on that for your life or for yourself or whatever it is. So you get rid of all of that. And again, please notice that. Notice in your own practice how a little bit of reduction in craving. And remember, one of the ways that the reduction in craving manifests itself is the mind becoming peaceful. Less activity, less willing going on, less thinking going on in the mind. Everything starting to calm down. This is how the reduction in craving manifests in your meditation practice. So notice that. Notice how beautiful it is when all of these things fade away. You think, wow, this is it, right? Now I'm starting to understand. And of course, with every step of understanding, you are enabling the reduction of avidya. This is what this is all about. Then we have the very last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Now this, because is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is this Noble Eightfold Path that is right view, right aim, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. That is the Noble Eightfold Path, the way leading to the end of suffering. And that too, you can slowly get an insight into why that is the case. You start to become more kind in your life, and you start see how kindness actually is something positive. You see how it enables you to feel better about yourself. You see how it enables you to function better, how it actually reduces craving, and how it is heading you in the right direction towards peace, as I said before, towards insight, towards awakening itself, and ultimately towards nibbana, towards extinguishment. Okay, so that is all for this morning. And I will see you again this afternoon at 3 o'clock. Yeah.